to 2007, guiding Argentina out of a calamitous economic crisis. His wife, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, was then elected president. Political analysts expected Néstor Kirchner to make another run for the presidency next year. Juan Ferrero, NPR News.
The World Series gets underway tonight in San Francisco with the home team Giants hosting the Texas Rangers. It's the first series ever for the Rangers, who send their ace Cliff Lee to the mound. He has never lost in the playoffs. The Giants start two-time Cy Young Award winner Tim Lincecum. The mayors of San Francisco and Arlington, Texas, have a bet riding on the outcome of the series. If the Rangers win, a shipment of Ghirardelli chocolate and sourdough bread heads south. If the Giants win, there'll be a feast of Texas-style barbecue headed up to the Bay Area. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Today is Susan Hopkins' birthday, and we're celebrating a special gift she has made. As Susan says,
WILL is a vital part of our family's lifelong learning, and even more important, of being informed citizens in a democracy.
The endowment fund Susan and her husband Lou created provides enough interest each year to pay for an entire day of broadcasting and learning on WILL radio. And that's something to celebrate.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about a very important trend in higher education, and it's something that we see in this country and all around the world. And our guest for the program is Ben Waldowski, and we'll be talking about a new book that he's authored. The title is The Great Brain Race, How Global Universities Are Reshaping the World. Princeton University Press is the publisher. He says that we are now in a time of unprecedented academic mobility. And the numbers here we're talking about are huge. There are now 3 million students who are pursuing higher education outside their home countries, and that is a 57% increase over the past 10 years. And if anything, it is a trend that is expected to continue, and these numbers are expected to grow. Now, it is a trend that has been greeted by some people in higher education administration with some suspicion and wariness. He says that they shouldn't be afraid of this. In fact, it is something that they should embrace. He says that what we are seeing here is the rise of a new kind of free trade, that is a free trade in minds. He says the global academic order is transforming in some far-reaching ways, and that is a good thing. As we talk this morning with Ben Waldowski, questions, comments are welcome. People are certainly encouraged to call with their thoughts, so we hope that people will keep them brief and stay on the topic, but certainly you can call 333-9455. That's for local folks here. So if you're in Champaign-Urbana, use that number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also send along your thoughts by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest, Ben Waldowski, is a senior fellow in research and policy at the Kauffman Foundation. He's also been a journalist. He worked for U.S. News and World Report. He was their education editor. He's also written for National Journal, San Francisco Chronicle, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. His writing has appeared there. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And Mr. Waldowski, hello.
Good morning, David. Nice to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I know when you're talking about this book that you've said that you really started out with a different kind of a project in mind.
That's right. Absolutely. You know, I had the notion that I might want to do a book that would sort of be a series of profiles of the best universities in the world. You know, I thought I'd travel around and try to just sort of paint a picture of these places. But I realized after a couple of months, I actually went to Shanghai for a conference where there were university folks from all over the world, and I realized that I felt like I was missing a much more interesting story, which is the way in which the old order, if you like, of elite universities is slowly but surely being shaken up as we get into this new era of very intense global competition.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything I mentioned just a couple of the numbers about how many students we're talking about and about the rate of increase? I don't know if there's anything else in the way of numbers just you might want to give that would illustrate the point.
Well, sure. I mean, there's so many things you could point to. The first thing I would say is, I mean, of course, you summarized very nicely some of the key trends. The projections are that those 3 million students that we now talk about, that number is projected to nearly triple to about 8 million students by 2025. Those are really extraordinary numbers. You know, we've had student mobility going back to the very first Western universities in Paris and Bologna and Oxford. You know, you sort of had this medieval tradition that developed of the wandering scholar. And that continued, you know, to varying degrees for centuries. You know, in the 19th century, we had lots of people going to Germany, which created really the first research universities with research and teaching under one roof, with this concept of academic freedom, the professors free from any kind of government interference. And that was a great magnet. But we just have not seen the kind of numbers that we're seeing now. And, I mean, just to finish this thought, you know, if you look at faculty as well, it's harder to get really good numbers. And, of course, there aren't as many faculty as there are students, but something like half the top physicists in the world no longer work in their home countries. So there really is just tremendous mobility on all fronts.
Yeah. And I suppose an important point, too, here is to make this, that this is the result, at least in part, of a very deliberate effort by universities and also by nations to recruit students and also faculty to get people to come to their universities.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, it's really, as I said, you know, it's really a global marketplace now. It's very competitive. And you see that, you know, in lots of different ways. If you look at PhD students, for example, postdoc students, you know, especially if you look at the sciences, for example, these students really make up what you might consider the backbone of research labs all around the world. They do a lot of the heavy lifting. And so the top students, you know, can really write their own tickets. Everybody wants them. At the same time, you know, for undergraduates, there's really a real focus on trying to bring in a lot of students. You know, in fact, the U.S. market share, some new figures just came out a few weeks ago from the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, you know, based in Paris, an organization of industrialized countries. I believe that our market share has gone from something like 25% down to about 19% because so many other countries, you know, Great Britain, Australia, a number of others, you know, traditional places that have gotten quite a lot of foreign students, France and Germany, they're all really trying hard to get more. Now, as it happens, you know, our numbers have actually increased, you know, in the last decade despite losing market share. And the reason is that the pie is getting bigger. So on the one hand, everybody's competing. But at the same time, there's just more and more students who are able to take advantage of these opportunities.
Mm-hmm. So clearly, it must be the case that that nations see this as a potentially very valuable resource for economic development. And I'm sure that the hope is that if they could encourage students particularly to come and do advanced work in their countries, that then those people would end up staying, and that would be to the benefit of the country.
Well, you know, I think in the best cases that's true. You know, I think in some places there's more conflicted views. I mean, I should say that, of course, you know, we can't forget the revenues that foreign students bring. Mm-hmm. And I was just in England last year doing some book talks for a little book tour, and, you know, they're having a real budget crisis. They've just announced very, very significant cuts to universities. And, of course, one of the things that some universities are looking at is, you know, bringing in foreign students, because they are outside the European Union, where the fees are basically the same as they are for British students, very heavily subsidized. Once you go beyond the EU, you have many foreign students who are paying they're paying full freight. They call them full-pay students. So, you know, there's no question there's a financial incentive to bring them in. At the same time, I think people can be sort of cynical about that. I think it's about more than just the money. I met a bunch of foreign students at the University of Sheffield in the north. And, you know, these people are very motivated. They're very ambitious. You know, they really want to make it in a Western university. They told me about how much better the opportunities were, the quality of the university, you know, getting away from, you know, some university systems in their home countries where there's corruption, you know, where there's a lot of plagiarism, even among faculty, where you can pay for good grades. A Western degree is really valued in their home countries if they go back. And I think, you know, that countries that are really being smart will see these students as a valuable source of human capital, of talent. It's one of the things that concerns me, though, in some countries, and frankly, including in this country, we have had some, of course, we've had a lot of foreign students come, and you know, a number have stayed and have made huge contributions to the economy. Places like Silicon Valley, a lot of firms have been founded by immigrants who've come here as students, so in some cases they may not be the founders, but they've been important, you know, members of these firms. But, you know, we've also had visa limitations. There's so-called H-1B visas for talented foreign workers, where there's been a cap on those visas, and they've often been very oversubscribed. It's been less of an issue the last few years with the economy being so bad, but there have been long periods when we have not let as many talented people into the country as I think we should.
Well, to date, I think the United States has been more successful than any other country in attracting foreign students and faculty from outside the U.S. Other countries, though, have put significant efforts into doing that, too, and are making gains. So I'd say aside from the United States, which countries have been most successful and what have they done to try to draw students?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, places like, you know, I mentioned Great Britain, Australia has attracted a lot of foreign students. They've seen some recent reductions, and that's partly because they have sort of they kind of realized they were letting people in to study things like hairdressing and giving them visas to stay, and they began to feel like that wasn't the kind of, that wasn't what they intended by their visa policy, trying to bring in, really talented folks. But yeah, Australia, Great Britain, as I said, you know, France and Germany are making big efforts. You know, you can go to these big conferences. There's an organization called NAFSA, which is an organization of sort of international educators, people who run, you know, offices and universities in the States and all over the world that are, you know, that are trying to bring in foreign students. And you go to their annual meeting. I was in Kansas City back in early June speaking there, and you go to this giant conference room. I mean, gosh, it's like probably a football field or that's the kind of scale of it. And there's just booths from every single country you can imagine, you know, in the Middle East, in Europe, in Australia, in Asia, and, of course, the Western institutions. Everybody's trying to, you know, make their pitch for getting more students. So, you know, it's something that people are working at. I guess one other thing they're doing, of course, is establishing offices all over the world. When I mentioned being in Shanghai for a conference, one of the things that got me interested is I was talking with a woman, from the University of Warwick in England, and she said, oh, I'm going to go and drop by and visit our office. And I said, you have an office in Shanghai? And it's like, yeah, they have offices all over the world. I believe they have at least a dozen or maybe a couple of dozen, and they use those as bases to try to bring in students, you know, and to try to really establish a presence. You know, there's a lot of marketing.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Ben Wildowski, he is author of a recently published book. The title of the book is The Great Brain Race, How Global Universities Are Reshaping the World. It's published by the Princeton University Press and looks at the globalization of higher education, looking at the fact that there are increasing numbers of students that study outside of their home countries, go to university outside of their home countries, and that there are many places around the world where they're making a very strong effort to recruit students and also to recruit international faculty. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you can also email us or will-talk@illinois.edu. This is something that I think is something of the proverbial two-edged sword. I think that college administrators, I'm sure, think that that's a good thing for the reasons that you cited, to attract talent from outside of the country. But they worry about a number of things. And I guess one of the things that they worry about is whether, and it happens not just here in the United States, but also in other countries as well, whether their own students, whether the domestic student population is being crowded out by people coming to school from outside that country.
Well, that's right. And I should say, you know, I in my view, it's not simply college administrators. I mean, frankly, a lot of colleges are seeking these students. But it's, you know, I think it goes beyond that. There is the sense, you know, in academia that we may be losing our edge, that, you know, other countries are catching up and that, you know, they're just developing their own universities, that they're sending people to, you know, to sort of suck up our knowledge and then take it back home. But these ideas, of course, so these concerns, you know, spread to the general public, to policymakers. You know, I think that it really affects a number of different groups. And, you know, I think there is, I mean, it really goes both ways. You know, in developing countries, particularly, there's a concern about brain drain, about people losing their best students to the West. And sometimes people do really, you know, in my view, pretty misguided things to try to prevent that. I was in India a few years ago, and one of the presidents of one of the elite engineering schools, the Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay, if they still use the old name for Mumbai, he basically said that students could no longer go overseas to get internships, you know, in universities or in businesses, because he wanted to keep the talented students at home. And conversely, as you said, in the West, you know, there is concern about crowding out of domestic students. You know, some years back, the University of Tennessee, for example, had a graduate dean who put a 20% quota on all foreign students in every graduate department. And, you know, that's a real problem when you have fields that are really, you know, looking for the most talented students, you know, things like chemistry, physics, engineering. You know, you often will have 60, maybe 65% of PhD students are from overseas. So there are these conflicted feelings. Fortunately, you know, what I've found is that there's really not much evidence of crowding out of domestic students. I just wrote about this recently. I do a blog for the Chronicle of Higher Education. It has a new global edition. I'll make a little plug for that. It's called Worldwise, and there's several of us from different places around the world contributing. And, you know, I cited a study that found that in some of the key periods when foreign PhD enrollment has grown very significantly in the States, many departments have expanded. So domestic enrollment has not suffered. And I think that sort of reflects something we should really bear in mind, which is it's not a zero-sum game. You know, there's not like a finite amount of there's not a finite number of PhDs that we can educate. And, you know, more broadly, there's not a finite amount of knowledge in the world. It's something that can spread. It's something that can grow. So I think in general, you know, the sort of fears about crowding out, the fears about other countries, you know, getting ahead of us, tend to be overblown. You know, as I said, it's not a zero-sum game. And I think we have to see knowledge as, you know, what economists call a public good. It's something that it's hard to keep within national borders. You know, it's something where discoveries in one country, you know, can be taken advantage of by scientists in other countries, by entrepreneurs, by innovators. So I think that we sort of need to move away from the mentality that if others are getting ahead, that necessarily means that we're going to fall behind. Now, that said, of course, we're in a competitive environment. We have to compete. We have to step up. But that's not the same as proceeding out of a sense of fear. You know, I feel that we need to sort of go forward with a sense of all the opportunities that exist in this kind of a world.
Yeah. Well, and certainly one of the things that I think that you talk about that is interesting to think about here in this country for a long time, it's certainly not been unusual for somebody to go to several different universities as they move through their education from undergrad to postgrad, and then maybe get their first teaching job one place and teach there for a while and then go someplace else and maybe go someplace else. You know, that's not unusual at all. What you're saying, though, is you think maybe in future we'll be seeing more of a global pattern of movement so that it might not be unusual for someone to study in one country and then go take teaching or research post in another country and then perhaps move to another country see that kind of pattern as well.
Absolutely. No, that's a great point. And in fact, you're touching on something I should have said earlier, because it relates to this question of whether crowding out or brain drain. Now we're seeing new patterns, as you suggest, and people sometimes call this brain circulation, or you hear the term brain exchange. And, you know, we're seeing things that are a bit different from the old sort of east-to-west migration. I mean, that certainly continues. You know, the U.S. is still a huge magnet for international students. But in a place like China, for example, which we get a lot of Chinese students, together with Indian students, those are the two largest groups that come to us. But, you know, China is actually taking in more foreign students now than the number of its own students that it sends overseas. There was an interesting study out of the Institute for International Education, a New York-based group, and they talked about how if you look at patterns of study and work, you know, Indians and Chinese, for example, might study in the U.S. or in Britain. They might go and get another degree in another Western country, and then they might come home to work, say, for a multinational. There are many, many more opportunities in these economies that have just grown enormously in the last 10 or 20 years. So you do see this kind of circulation, and I'll just give one example that I like to talk about at the faculty level. There's a guy named Chunfeng Shi, who is a very prominent material scientist and academic leader. He was born in Singapore. I believe he's ethnically Chinese. He went to grad school in Canada for a master's, went to Harvard for a PhD. He worked in industry for a while. He became a professor of mechanical engineering at Brown University, you know, very distinguished place. And sort of that by itself is sort of a classic trajectory in the post-World War II years, you know, a guy from the developing world who goes to the West. But then he sort of reversed the pattern because he was recruited back to the National University of Singapore, and he headed an institute there. He eventually became president. So already that's a complete reversal of the pattern we think about. And then a year or so ago, a new university opened up in Saudi Arabia. It's called the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. The acronym is KAUST. And they recruited Chun Fong Shi to become their first president. So he traveled across the world for that. So there's a real sort of crisscrossing pattern. And, you know, I don't suggest that he is typical. I mean, clearly not everybody is moving around like that. But I do think that he sort of symbolizes, you know, he's emblematic of the kind of possibilities that exist in the new world that we're in.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers. Let's talk with them. First is in DeWitt County on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I have a niece who got a freshly minted master's degree in, I forget what you call it, but about handling student affairs, you know, running dormitories and that sort of thing. And her first job, she jetted off to a new university in Doha, Qatar, which was an intentionally international university. It seems to draw mostly from Muslim nations. But you know, the whole point of it seems, I believe it was tied to some American university, too. So it's sort of like a westernized education with deliberately a widely international students. And can you tell me anything about that place or that sort of movement?
Sure. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, since we haven't touched on that yet. I'm not certain what institution that might be, but in the Middle East, you know, broadly speaking, there's just very big interest in, of course, they've sent a lot of students to the West, including many students in the United States, but there's a very big interest there, I think, in looking beyond their oil economies to knowledge economies and trying to provide better opportunities at home for their citizens, for people in the region. So actually, I visited Doha when I was working on my book on the Great Brain Race, and I visited a place called Education City, which is a sort of compound that was built on the edge of Doha in Qatar. And there you have a bunch of Western universities that have set up sort of mini campuses. You have Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. You have the McGill School of Journalism at Northwestern. You have the Cornell University's Med School, the Weill School of Medicine. Texas A&M has its engineering program there. And those are, you know, branch campuses. That's the term that's used. And, I mean, that's another interesting figure. There's now about 160 of those around the world, and that's grown about 43% in just a few years. So those are countries that are trying to provide these kinds of degrees to students at home. In some cases, you have young women who's, you know, it's a fairly traditional part of the world, and they would probably not easily be able to go to the West, certainly on their own. They might be able to go if they had a male relative sort of as an escort or somebody who could be over there with them. But they also, in their home universities, like the University of Qatar, men and women study separately. They're in separate classes. So it's sort of a big deal to be able to go to a top university across town and to be able to study in co-ed classes and to get the kind of education that, unfortunately, has not really been available close to home. And just to add one more thing, of course, I don't know exactly where your niece might have been, but there are also a number of other partnerships going on. There's just huge interest in the Middle East in creating partnerships with Western universities. Sometimes it's branch campuses, but there's lots of other forms that these arrangements take. And as I said, it's all about trying to improve the kinds of opportunities that exist there, so that they can, you know, think ahead to a time when oil may not be the mainstay of their economies anymore.
Yes, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to somebody here in Champaign. This is someone on a cell phone, line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder if you're, I tuned in late, so you might have covered this, if you're familiar with what's called the export control laws, which are a major factor in, what should I say, especially in the sciences pertaining to foreign students and faculties going abroad, and the fact that faculty sometimes disregard these laws because they're not aware of it, even though every university has to deal with this, and that there have actually been major problems for some universities because the faculty refused to abide by the rules which the university kept on insisting, which are actually federal government laws. So I'll get off and see if you can talk about this. This is a ongoing major factor, and University of Illinois has a special office that deals with this. So thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. It is a very good question. And, you know, it's not something that I spent a lot of time on in the book. To be honest, you know, it's one of those issues that I continue looking at the subject, I'd like to do more on this. You know, this essentially gets into the question of national security. And, you know, there may be certain kinds of projects, you know, federally funded projects, Defense Department funded research, where there's, you know, there's national security concerns about the extent to which we want foreign students working on these, particularly students from countries, you know, that we view as problematic. And, you know, I think, like so many of these things, it's a balancing act. I know that some academics feel that the rules sort of go overboard and that they prevent them from bringing in the kind of talent that they would like. But at the same time, you know, you can certainly, you know, think of scenarios where you don't want people from, you know, countries that are you know, hostile to us to one degree or another, or whose capabilities we do not want to encourage in certain, you know, defense-related areas. You know, we may not want them to have easy access to some, you know, some kinds of technology. So I guess all I can really say is that this is a live issue. It's controversial. I think there have certainly been times when it comes to visas in the post-9/11 era when I think we made it pretty hard for foreign students to get visas. And I think, you know, once again, you can make the case, you know, for students from certain countries, for exercising a sort of heightened degree of scrutiny, if you like. But I think we have to be careful because, you know, we do not want to turn away great talent that can improve our universities as centers of learning and, you know, that can really improve for those who stay on. You know, a lot of these students can be a huge asset to our innovative economy. So I think we've just got to try and you know, be aware of that as a competing factor and not go overboard.
We're at our midpoint of this hour of Focus, and let me introduce again the guest, Ben Waldowski. He's a senior fellow in research and policy at the Kauffman Foundation. He also has been the education editor of U.S. News and World Report, economic policy correspondent for the National Journal, higher education reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's also written for the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, among other publications. He's the author of a recent book, The Great Brain Race, How Global Universities Are Reshaping the World, published by the Princeton University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to talk a little bit more about satellite, Western universities setting up satellite campuses elsewhere in the world, for example, as you talked about happening in the Middle East, this is something that we're also seeing rapid growth. I think the number now that you cite is there are now more than 160, and that's a significant increase, 43% increase over the last couple of years, and it's something that we no doubt will see more of. Now, you can imagine a number of reasons that universities would do this, economic and otherwise. What, though, really, what's in it for an American university to set up a satellite campus in some other country?
Well, there are lots of motivations, and I think, in fact, we have to be cautious. Sometimes, you know, people will say, you know, this movement is booming, or, you know, one university will close down and they'll say it's doomed. And I think we have to understand that, first of all, I think these are often kind of entrepreneurial ventures. You know, there are things that universities are trying. You know, they're feeling like they're in this global environment. They want to you know, spread their presence in certain ways, or there's demand for their presence in other parts of the world. In some cases, universities do this basically at no financial risk. That's the case in Education City, which we talked about in Doha. The Qatari government is pouring money into this because, you know, they, for their own reasons, they want to create these centers which serve not only students in Qatar. There aren't that many Qataris. So they also serve students from around the region. You know, an American university can go over there, and, you know, I think their prime concern is going to be, you know, making sure that their brand is not diluted, to use those terms, you know, to make sure the quality is maintained. And then, frankly, the other side wants that as well. The Qatari government, through the Qatar Foundation, which oversees all this, they insisted that these degrees not be any different from the degrees that are earned back home in the States. So, for example, you get a degree from the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, it doesn't say Georgetown in Qatar. It just says Georgetown. So I think the Qataris view that as a way of giving a really heavy incentive to the Western places to maintain quality. But so getting back to this overall question, though, I think places are doing it. They're invited in sometimes. There's not a lot of risk. I think they think it's kind of an interesting venture. It's a way of meeting demand in places where they might want to extend their presence. In other cases, universities are hoping to make money. And there you've seen some success. You know, there's a Scottish place, I believe it mostly focuses on career-oriented degrees, called Harriet Watt University. They're in Dubai, and they've made money there. There's been a lot of demand, and I think their planning has been good. On the other hand, Michigan State was in Dubai, and they pulled out earlier this year. I think the financial projections were not what they had hoped. They didn't get the kind of student enrollment they'd hoped. And you do see these flameouts. You know, an Australian university, University of New South Wales, went to Singapore a few years ago, and they had very ambitious projections about enrollment, but the demand wasn't there, or perhaps they picked the wrong price point, and they closed down, I recall, after less than a year. So, you know, there's the prestige, there's the wanting to be a global player. In some cases, there's the financial motivations. I mean, just one final example, New York University, headed by John Sexton, who's, you know, really very ambitious and very entrepreneurial on the global front, they just opened a campus in Abu Dhabi. Again, you know, not something that involved any financial risk to NYU, but John Sexton really wants to create a network of campuses around the world, and he doesn't even like to call them branch campuses. He uses this term, the global network university, and the idea is you might be able to, you know, get a degree just fully in Abu Dhabi. They'd like to open up in China. You could perhaps start in China and finish in New York, or start in Abu Dhabi and finish in China. So people are also using these opportunities as a way to just sort of rethink the concept of a university that's very heavily bounded by the place where its headquarters is, the place where it started. Hmm.
Another caller here, someone who is listening in Indiana, Kentland, Indiana, our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I just returned a few months ago from Beijing, where I taught at the university, China University of Communications. What I noticed when the kids had a project in Germany or even Hong Kong, when they came back, they blossomed. They had bloomed. They gained so much. And I thought, in sense of teamwork, in sense of workflow, just matured exponentially. I was wondering, I thought maybe it was attributable to the censorship in China itself, but do American kids seem to bloom that much when they go abroad? And I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the question. You know, it's great to hear from somebody who's been out there in the trenches, you know, and, you know, I'm not sure exactly. I mean, there may be some survey data on this. You know, my research and my book is not really about study abroad, you know, for American students. You know, I'm particularly interested in really degree-seeking students, you know, students who are going overseas, whether from the States to other countries, which is, of course, not happening that often right now, and also from other countries, you know, to the West. Or, as I said, you know, people may go to China for degrees. I think among study abroad students, yeah, I mean, certainly anecdotally you hear that it's, you know, it's broadening, you know, that people are exposed to different thinking, different cultures. You know, and I think that's generally a good thing, although I don't know that is, you know, I'm not sure that that's exactly the same as globalization. That's almost like enrichment for students. What I do think, though, is if a student, you know, let's say from China, goes and gets a degree in Great Britain, and I heard this from some Chinese students I spoke to last week who had just started in England. They were in a sort of transitional program run by a for-profit, run by Kaplan, which helps get them ready for British universities. And just after being there a month, they said, you know, there was less rote learning. They were really being encouraged to offer their own ideas. And I think that, you know, we tend to admire a lot of the virtues, you know, that we see in the Asian education system, you know, tremendous hard work, perseverance, you know, very high standards, particularly in certain fields. But when they look to the West, I think they tend to look at teaching students, you know, how to think, teaching students to question authority, to be analytical and not just to memorize. And so I do think that if the caller, you know, saw her students in Beijing really blossoming after having this kind of exposure, as she said, in a world where there isn't censorship, I think that that is a great part of the appeal of the Western system. As you know, we know we're not perfect. God knows our own universities in the States, and we have some real excellent places. We have some mediocre places. But I do think that we offer really a tradition of free thought, which is very appealing to a lot of places.
Well, that I think gets to the question, or raises this question. Say you were a country, and you were interested in welcoming universities from the West. Say it could be Europe, could be the United States, to come and set up satellite campuses and start teaching your students. But the thing is that there's all sorts of things that come with that that may be unintended. You're bringing in foreign faculty. Maybe some students are also coming from those countries. And it's just not possible for you to keep the lid on the introduction of ideas and ways of thinking that you might not be real happy about. Mm-hmm. How do countries think about that?
You know, I think that, I mean, I'll tell you what I hope will happen, which is I think, you know, a lot of countries have come to understand, you know, including countries like, you know, China or the Saudi Arabia that aren't democracies, that have, unfortunately have been pretty repressive places in many ways. But I do think that they have come to understand that universities and research universities in particular are sort of the pathway to innovation and to economic growth. They don't guarantee it, but they sure help you get there. They've really, a place like China has done a lot to improve mass enrollment. They've quadrupled their enrollment just in a decade or so, and they've also spent a lot of money on improving their own universities. And part of that is recruiting people who've had training in the West. A lot of overseas Chinese have been recruited back to China. And so I agree. These places, you know, will bring in a sort of tradition of, you know, free open discourse that may be threatening to an authoritarian regime. Of course, I think that's a good thing. And I think that, you know, countries that are bringing in universities, you know, for because they think it's important to academic and economic development, I think are going to have to come face to face with what are the values that have made these universities important. And I think, you know, even something like, you know, just high academic standards, competitive environment, peer review, those are all important. The Shanghai Jiao Tong University rankings, they came up with some global college rankings. You know, I think they have tried to make sure that, you know, universities get points in research for publishing in peer-reviewed journals. But, so they can't just publish in some of the journals that have cropped up in China where people can just, you know, crank out articles. And I think that comes back to your question in a sense that I think, you know, the whole principle of meritocracy, I think, is an important one, you know, that has been associated with Western universities. Again, we're not perfect by any means, but I think we have certainly moved in that direction in the United States, and I think globally that's now beginning to happen. And I think in totalitarian or authoritarian places, I think that those values are helpful. And I'll return to the Middle East for a second. My view, and it's a cautious view, but from what I've seen and what I've, you know, some of the research I've done, I think that on balance, some of these Western places are likely to have a liberalizing effect. You know, in a place like we talked about Doha, again, coming back to Education City. Now, you know, Qatar is, I guess I would say, it's a moderate Arab regime. It's not Saudi Arabia. But it's certainly a place where there's censorship of the Internet, certainly mild censorship, and where it's not a democracy and there isn't this great tradition of rigorous public debate. But in Education City, everywhere I went, I saw posters for a debate series that was sponsored there by the Qatar Foundation. And it's sort of the Oxford-style debates where you debate a resolution. And the resolution on all these posters was clearly very much provocative, in your face, and it was resolved. This House believes that Gulf Arabs value profit over people. So, you know, clearly that was designed to be controversial. And when I talked to some of the hosts there, I mean, the officials from the Qatar Foundation, they clearly relished that. They wanted to bring some of those values. I talked to a guy from the Medill School, the journalism school at Northwestern, and he was visiting local newspapers and saying, you know, you don't have to run a picture of the emir on the front page every day. So in a number of ways, and I could go on, the fact that men and women are studying together is pretty revolutionary. That's even happening in Saudi Arabia at KAUST. Which is a big deal. The first week that KAUST opened, this King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, with men and women studying together, One of the an imam who's on the religious governing council for Saudi Arabia said that it was evil for men and women to be studying together, and King Abdullah fired him that first week. So, you know, I'm not suggesting that's going to transform these places overnight, but I do think that, you know, these kinds of institutions, I think, can nudge countries in the right direction.
Ben Wildowski is our guest. He's a senior fellow in research and policy at the Kauffman Foundation. He is author of The Great Brain Race, How Global Universities Are Reshaping the World. We have about 10 minutes left. We'll go to another caller here, Belgium, line one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning today.
Good morning.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate a bit, and I don't want this to sound too terribly parochial, but in these days of financial problems that we have, especially in the state situation, California, Illinois, New York, places where there are large, important universities that are state-supported, isn't it really not to the individual's advantage in the state to finance a university that is going to give some preference to foreign students?
I think it's a very reasonable question. I'm sorry, was there more to your question, sir?
Well, no, not really. Let's just go with that.
Well, I think it's a very reasonable question. It's certainly something that people, you know, have worried about for years, and you know, we're in a very, very tough, as you say, a very tough economic climate. I would say I would disagree with the idea of giving preference to foreign students. I don't believe that that's happening by and large. You know, I think that foreign students are appealing, you know, oftentimes, as I mentioned, in, you know, PhD programs, they offer, you know, they're very talented. You know, a lot of departments at top universities, as I said, in certain programs, you know, engineering, physics, computer science, economics actually has a ton of foreign students. You know, these departments want the best. It's the principle of merit, and they're finding talent wherever they can. Having said that, you're right. There are places that are state-funded that are bringing in a lot of foreign students. Now, in a number of cases, those students are paying more than, you know, American students, residents of the state, because the foreign students are often not subsidized to the same degree. Some of them do get, you know, a professor may get a federal research grant, and with part of his or her grant, it's possible to pay for a student to be an RA, a research assistant, or to help, you know, to help as a teaching assistant. But I think fundamentally, I think that we have to see this in terms of, you know, what this kind of talent pool brings to a state. And, you know, this is not always going to be easy politically. I mean, certainly in the state legislatures, there's going to be scrutiny of how many foreign students are coming in. But I think we sort of have to try to persuade, or I would like to persuade people, that the kind of talent that comes with foreign students is very, very helpful to a state and to a state's economy. And that I think, you know, as I said, the crowding out problem, I think, is often less of a problem than people imagine. I mean, there are a number of programs that have grown because of demand. You know, if there's enough demand from foreign students combined with demand domestically, there's no reason these programs can't get bigger.
Sir, can I point out, you pointed out that it's a zero-sum game that way, but really it isn't, because if you look at it another way, there's only so many spaces. Even though you say we can build more spaces, but we don't, because it's too expensive. And we haven't really built new colleges and stuff even today. You don't find in the states here, you don't find places where they're opening up new colleges or making much larger state universities, because the state won't give us money. Take the example of University of Illinois. They really would like the state money their own, you know. So that's really what I'm getting at right there.
Yeah, well, I hear what you're saying. I mean, without addressing every single point there, I guess I think that there is evidence over time that, you know, I mean, look, I think we should be a lot more innovative in terms of our own domestic universities. There's a lot we could do. We could use more technology, and there may be cases where we should be opening more spaces. You know, I think that historically, you know, in 1970, only about half of high school graduates went on to some form of higher education in this country. Now we're at 70%. So we have a lot more students going on to higher ed. So I think we have expanded. In fact, we've expanded at a time when foreign student enrollment has also increased. So, again, I would say I don't think it is not a zero-sum game in my view. But, look, you're right. The state budget situation is very tough. I think that, you know, you sort of have to look at the kinds of revenues that may come with foreign students. And I would think, and certainly I'm aware of studies showing that in some programs, in PhD programs, for example, it has been possible to
to make the programs bigger. But, you know, I would certainly, I'm sympathetic with what you're saying in the sense that, you know, when money is just really tight, it's hard to be as flexible as one would like to be.
I want to thank the caller. We have about 5 minutes. I wanted to bring up another subject because it's been controversial and also because you had something to do with it. Back in the 80s, U.S. News and World Report, where you worked, started to do college rankings. And I think that a lot of college administrators really hated it. They were really unhappy about it. But there was no going back, apparently. And now people all over the world are doing this.
That's right.
This is something that you make the argument that, well, that's not a bad thing. In fact, maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, I do think that rankings are a good thing. And, you know, they go back a long time, actually. Well before U.S. News, there were a variety of rankings. Actually, the first one that I found, which I love, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley gave to me. It's a chart from 1895 showing students' physical fitness levels at Berkeley and comparing them to men on the East Coast and showing how, after doing all these calisthenics in the healthy Bay Area air, these California men, of course it was all men, they improved and they surpassed the blue blood guys on the East Coast. So we've had an impulse to rank for a long time. As you said, U.S. News in 83 started the rankings, and they became very popular and very controversial. They're now all over the world, 40 or so rankings in individual countries. And now we have a couple of global rankings. I mentioned this Chinese university, Shanghai Jiao Tong, which started the first global ranking in 2003. There's a British publication, Times Higher Education, which does a ranking, started in 2004. And there's another organization, QS, that does rankings. But, you know, my feeling is there's absolutely no question that rankings have lots of flaws. I mean, certainly when I was at U.S. News and editing the college guides, we heard all the time from college presidents and others, you know, who felt the methodology was wrong. There is just generally, I think, a feeling that rankings, you know, measure the wrong things, or they create perverse incentives. They don't really tell you how effective universities are. But, you know, first of all, I would defend a number of measures. You know, I think when rankings look at things like graduation rates, research spending, I think those are all relevant to what makes a university successful. What we're really missing is better measures of value added, of how much students learn when they're on campus, of how effective teaching is. But I think we have to accept that, you know, rankings are helpful to students, to consumers. I think they can be helpful to universities to improve what they're doing. They can be helpful to government policymakers just by providing an external yardstick to help figure out, you know, where your shortcomings are, where you need to improve. Practically speaking, you know, rankings are not going to go away. We're in the age of accountability. And so I think the most realistic position to take is that, you know, rankings are flawed. But the challenge is really to make them better. And there is a lot of interesting stuff going on. I mean, just very briefly, the OECD, which I mentioned earlier, has this new assessment project going on. They don't call it a ranking, but it's trying to focus on a broader range of factors, especially undergraduate education, looking across different countries and trying to figure out how you can compare effectiveness of different university systems. The European Union is doing something that they call a more holistic college ranking. And the British publication Times Higher Education just spent a year completely revamping their ranking, and that was in response to some of the criticisms. They've tried to fix some of some of this gets a little bit technical, but the way they were measuring research citations was flawed. They changed the amount of emphasis on reputational surveys. It's still there, but it's not as much. They did things like trying to improve the quality of the sample of people that were surveyed. So I think that all of these kinds of moves suggest that rankings are slowly, but I hope, you know, continually going to improve, and I think they're going to become more and more useful.
Well, just as a way of finishing up here, we have about a minute or so, and I'm sorry we have a caller here we can't take, we just don't have time. But as a way of finishing up, the kinds of trends that you talk about in the book, and we've been talking about this, growth of the global education marketplace, it's not going to go away. And if anything, that this is something that's going to grow. Do you think that this is going to mean that in the future we will think differently about what a university is?
I think that is a great way to finish. And, you know, I think that, you know, you have to approach this with some humility, you know, when you're kind of crystal ball glazing. But I do think that when you look ahead, you know, one thing we should consider is that this whole paradigm of us versus them is already sort of out of date, and I think that will probably continue. You know, we have all kinds of research collaborations across borders. We have all kinds of university partnerships. We may see just different ways of putting universities together in the future. I talked to a British university president, Nigel Thrift at the University of Warwick, who uses this model of what they call firm theory in business, where you might see successful institutions creating branches elsewhere where there's demand. They may create strategic partnerships with other places that can complement their strengths. They might ultimately make mergers with other institutions. So you could ultimately see the university equivalent of multinationals. We just don't know what's around the corner. You know, things can change. I mentioned that Americans flocked to Germany in the 19th century to go to these first research universities. Well, we took that model. We copied it. We created places like Johns Hopkins University and the University of Chicago. And then we perfected it. We became the best in the world after World War II. So now, 150 years later, the Germans, whose university system has a lot of problems, they're looking at us and trying to copy our model. And that's in a pretty short period of time, you know, historically. So it's absolutely true that the patterns that we look at now, the kind of competition we worry about, the patterns of mobility, they've already changed quite a bit, and they may change a good deal more down the road. Mm.
Well, I guess I suppose also some people that would view this with alarm, and they would, for example, look at universities that set up branch campuses and do research outside of the United States. And part of the reason that they do it is that it's cheaper for them to do research work outside of the United States. Would we get into the kind of outsourcing that we've seen in private industry that would mean that multinational universities would actually be a loss of opportunities for work for people in the United States?
You know, it's a little hard to say. I mean, there are already partnerships. Yale University is working with some Chinese universities where they do get the advantage of this great lab space. It's very inexpensive. They have very highly trained technicians. They don't have the sort of high-level science expertise that the Yale professors, who are mostly Chinese expats, can provide. But, you know, I think that's really a win-win. I mean, yeah, there may be, you know, the current arrangements, you know, are not, I think, going to be set in stone. And you may see people developing, again, using the language of economics and trade, their comparative advantage. But, you know, I'm a free trader, and I think that ultimately the benefits of these kinds of collaborations are going to be so significant that I think that they outweigh some of the, you know, the transitional problems. You know, there might be some dislocations, you know, absolutely. But I think if you create a world where there's a higher quality research, perhaps a higher volume of research, and the kind of innovation and economic growth that tends to come with that, I think that's going to be good for everybody.
Ben Wildavsky is our guest. He's a senior fellow in research and policy at the Kauffman Foundation. He is the author of The Great Brain Race. It's recently published. The subtitle of the book is How Global Universities Are Reshaping the World, and it is published by the Princeton University Press. Mr. Wildavsky, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Support for Focus comes from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982 with four area locations, including inside the ARC, the Illini Student Union, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is available at bodyworkassociates.com.
In the next hour of Focus, we will be talking about American politics. Our guest will be Paul Pearson. He teaches at UCLA. He's professor of political science there. He is the co-author of a recent book that is titled Winner Take All Politics, and it takes a look at income inequality in the United States, something that has been growing very steadily over the last few decades, and asks the question, well, why is that? A number of different explanations have been offered. He and his co-author on the book, Jacob Hacker, say really it's all about politics. So we'll get more on that in the next part of the show. So hope you will stay with us. First, though, we'll break, as we usually do, for an update on the markets and some news from National Public Radio.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity market, where at the Chicago Board of Trade, as well as in Kansas City, the wheat market appears to be finding a bottom and has firmer prices at this hour. Those firmer prices, though, not helping pull up corn at the moment. And the soybean market is also softer. Let's look at particulars in Kansas City. December wheat now at 752 and a quarter, up 13 and three quarters. March 765 and a quarter, up 11 and a quarter. May 769, up six and a half. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 702, up 10. March 728, down three. December corn 566 and a half, down 4.5. March 578 and a half, down 5.5. May 583, down 6.